That's Satadub, Augustus Pablo. Augustus Pablo passed away on this day in 1999. Welcome back, everybody. Good to have you here. I'm Mark Steiner here on your source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Now, we've been focusing a lot of our time on the Mark Steiner Show over the last several weeks on the Baltimore Uprising in the wake of the death of Freddie Gray. And we think we want to need to talk about many issues facing us, especially issues of national importance, including the race for presidency and the battle over the Trans-Pacific Partnership that's taking place in the U.S. Congress right now. But let's start with the presidential race. You know, what's shaping up is really interesting. We're watching Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton, self-declared Democratic socialist Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who is running for the nomination. And on May 30th, we'll be hearing, I'm sure, that former Governor Martin O'Malley is declaring his candidacy for the presidency of the United States and Democratic side and poising himself as a progressive Democratic candidate. On the Republican side, there's Florida Governor, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who everybody says is the front runner, but there's a man being backed by tons of money, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Libertarian leading Senator Rand Paul, who keeps taking his foot out of his mouth, but he's out there all the time. Florida Senator Marco Rubio and Baltimore's own, well, he's no longer in Baltimore, he lives in Florida now, Ben Carson, former neurosurgeon who's become a favorite of the right wing, and most likely Scott Walker will jump in for the Republican nomination as well. So it'll be a crowded field, and we want to hear your thoughts on that at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. But join us, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on that in the first part of our program here as we look at national politics. We're joined, continuing in the studio, is Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at UMBC and co-editor of Black Berries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. And joining us has not been around for at least a couple few months, which is really too bad, and we're happy he's back, is Edward Wyckoff Williams, contributing editor of The Root, political contributor and special correspondent at Al Jazeera, and columnist and political analyst who appears on MSNBC, ABC, CBS Washington, and many other places, and Catalina Bird, in-studio media consultant, and of course, co-host of No Hooks for the Hip Hop Chronicles right here in WEAA. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you.
Edward, how are you?
Very good, buddy. It's been way too long.
Way too long. Good to have you back.
Good to be back.
So let's begin. And folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. Let's start with this presidential primary before I ask you some other questions. I mean, it's just interesting to watch how this is kind of shaping up. And clearly, as the New York Times was reporting yesterday, the Republicans going after Hillary, not so much to undergut her, I think, to push her to have a Republican beat her, but actually push her out of the primary altogether so somebody else is running against whoever is a Republican candidate. Edward?
Well, I'm not sure if they actually have a clear strategy. It seems like the GOP is so crowded. The GOP field itself is so crowded at the moment. Hillary Clinton has name recognition, and she doesn't really have any serious opposition in the Democratic Party, and that's partly because the Democrats themselves have not. I think in light of Obama's success in 2008 and 2012, they weren't really thinking about 2016. They haven't nurtured a field of their own. And so Hillary Clinton, in a lot of ways, is their best bet, particularly if she is smart enough to bring on board a vice presidential candidate of color. And so one of the things that I talked to HUD Secretary Julian Castro about when I interviewed him a couple of months ago for Salon.
Yes, is what?
Salon was that very thing. And I said, you know, I'm looking forward to you running on this ticket, and I don't think that this ticket can win without someone like you. Now, someone like him could also be perhaps, you know, Cory Booker, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where her head is, but I certainly know that Hillary Clinton cannot win without, or at least it won't be an easy path to winning. She could win, but it won't be an easy path to winning without balancing out that ticket. But that said, she has way more name recognition than like a Bernie Sanders does. I think that I believe in Bernie Sanders' ideals, and I love how bold he is and progressive he is.
Yes, yes, me
but
too.
I think as a candidate on the national stage, he is lacking. Mark O'Malley, however, in light of the, you know, Martin O'Malley, I'm sorry.
Yep.
He's a blank canvas, and to that end, I'm not quite sure if we know exactly where he's going to stand in the race.
Where do you live? Where are you from?
Finish your sentence.
No, I was done. I'm really looking forward to the feedback. So you guys are from Maryland. And so
yes,
you know
we know.
Well.
I was so confused.
I have 23 years 23 years of interviews with Councilman, Mayor, and Governor O'Malley. 23 years of interviewing Martin O'Malley here in mm-hmm. Baltimore, Maryland, when we do our local programs. So your thoughts, Kathleen, then we'll go up to Kimberly.
I don't think that the GOP is creating this because honestly, they should want Hillary to become the Democratic nominee. It guarantees that no matter who in their clown car they elect in the primary will win. But
I'm not sure about that.
I'm telling you, and I've been saying it for months now, we're not going to have two historic presidencies behind each other. We're not going to have the first woman president behind the first black president. It's just not.
That's a fair point.
And the country's not ready for it. The electorate's not ready for it. And I think that the Democrats, if they really want to continue the momentum that the president has made in these 8 years, they have to go and find an old white man. The country is going back to what it knows, what the other 43 presidents were. And if it's not an old one, it needs to at least be a middle-aged and accomplished one.
Yeah, go Martin O'Malley.
No. I said accomplished. Did you hear me preface that with accomplished, though? Accomplished.
Kimberly.
Martin O'Malley is a blank slate or a blank canvas.
For the nation,
to the nation. To the nation.
Absolutely.
And that is fair. So I do want to at least acknowledge that point, although we found it humorous in the studio, that he is a blank canvas to the nation. And that could work in his favor because that was something that I think a number of people looked at Obama as being when he first spoke at the Democratic National Convention. So that's a fair point. However, I think even as recently as what we saw happen with the Baltimore unrest in the city, that O'Malley's name started to come up a bit more, where people were starting to make these connections to say that, yes, he was mayor years ago, but there is a connection between his time in office in Baltimore City and then what he did at the state level as governor that has to be taken into context and understood that he was a part of the problem. And I think that piece will come back to haunt.
It could come back to haunt him, and I think that we have to also remember that many activists in the community might not like Martin O'Malley or have liked him in office, but he won by large margins when he ran.
Yes, he did.
The last time he ran for mayor and the last time he ran for governor. So, I mean, those things have to be taken into account as well.
Yep.
So that there's a lot of angst against him, but it doesn't mean that the majority of people don't like him.
And was he winning by large margins among African Americans?
He did in the last race against then sitting Governor Ehrlich.
Right,
he did.
Yeah,
and he did in the election after as well. And I think that though there's a real mixed feeling here. And I think that, I mean I'm not so sure I agree with Kathleen about Hillary Clinton where the country is. I think they may be ready for this, especially if I agree with Edward. I've been saying the same thing Edward was saying, that if she has someone like Castro on her ticket. It pulls in voters. If you cannot have an all-white ticket in the Democratic candidacy again, I think you're going to have young voters, Latino voters, and black voters come out and vote for that ticket in numbers they did before.
So she couldn't have O'Malley on her ticket?
No, I do not think so.
I don't think so either.
She doesn't need him on her ticket.
No, she doesn't, but
she
I'm just thinking
bring
about
anything.
Just thinking about someone who is new, fresh to the national scene, someone who doesn't have the same amount of baggage that Hillary and all the others do at the table, would that be something that works to her advantage?
And as a commentator who knows very little about Martin O'Malley, I would say that Martin O'Malley with Julian Castro or Cory Booker has a better chance of getting into the White House than Hillary Clinton with Martin O'Malley as a ticket.
Yeah, I think so. I do think that given this world and the world today, that with the front runners all being white in the Democratic primary, that having a person of color on that ticket means a lot.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because I wonder if it's because I am a resident of this area and state that I even was shocked that O'Malley started this consideration process because I never saw him at that national level. And even, I mean, and it was
it's
confirmed.
All he's ever wanted to be.
But it was confirmed for me even during the last election when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention. He was flat then. He offered little to the conversation that gave us a sense that, oh, I can easily see. Think about it. This is what we thought about Obama. When Obama spoke, we then immediately started to say, ha, this is someone we need to watch.
And you remember he was stuck in between Julian Castro and Duval Patrick.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
It was a tough place to be.
It was. It was. But there was nothing that I pulled away from that said, oh, he's making a mark here and I can see what is to come.
See, when he spoke at the Democratic National Convention as mayor is when other people saw.
Governor. Last time he was governor.
He was mayor. The first time he spoke at the convention. The first time he spoke at the National Convention.
No, but we're talking about the last time he spoke.
Right. No, I'm not talking about the last time.
Okay.
Some of us saw it then when he spoke
at the convention as mayor.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Okay, it's like, and at that point he had not yet been governor. And we kind of know that this is all he's ever wanted to be. So you kind of watch him and you see what he does. He went on the defensive when his zero tolerance policies and things became a subject of the national conversation around what happened in Baltimore. And you saw him he did a walkthrough in Baltimore with CNN. He went very, very defensive. He's still not ready to define what his presidency would look like. But if you listen, he's had a great machine behind him in terms of how to run a race and how to do outreach and field to get votes. But he's never defined any path, not as mayor, not as governor. And that's the scary part about how easily it is to sway the general electorate is you don't even have to define
yourself.
You can be
that empty.
You can be that empty.
And still be successful.
And with a great team behind you, still be successful.
Right.
Well, I mean,
a part of the problem there is white male privilege, right? So when you talk about him not being exciting at the DNC, you wondering why is he even considering a race for the presidency? What does he have to offer? It makes me think of people like George W. Bush, who, you know, for all intents and purposes, could hardly string a sentence together, or someone like Sarah Palin, who can barely read correctly, and yet these people, because of their white privilege, I think largely because of that, they actually think that they do have something to offer. They think that they belong there. It is hubris, and it is it's something you wouldn't understand, because I think for us, we would certainly not aspire to be in positions of power without having the goods to back that up. The other thing, though, that I wanted to say, and that's not to be too mean to Martin O'Malley, because back to what I said,
right.
I really don't know much about him.
Right.
But the other thing that I wanted to say about you guys talking about the Democrats and the danger of running an all-white ticket, I think that the one thing the GOP is very clear on is that they will certainly have a Latino on their ticket. Granted, it would be Marco Rubio, probably, who doesn't even support immigration reform, which is problematic, but they are all about optics, and they are all about propaganda, and they will convince people that they are for them once the general election is in play, and it's a dangerous, dangerous thing if Democrats don't do the same thing, essentially.
Let me go to the phones here, and then we'll see what would happen if between Jeb Bush and Ben Carson. Just kidding, but talk about the Republican government. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We have somebody reminding us that during the uprising here in Baltimore, people they were yelling at Martin O'Malley in the streets that this was all his fault, and he responded very meekly that he did the best he could.
That's not what we want in a president.
No. Stephen tweeted in, Clinton has by far the best shot, but Bernie Sanders will force her to swing to the left in the primaries. And Key of Life tweeted in, he should move on to something else. I don't think he's a strong leader, Martin O'Malley. Those were the two tweets who just got in. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air. Line three.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning, Clarence.
You know, I want to quote my favorite guy in this whole thing when he was speaking in reference to North Korea. If you even think about tipping a missile with a nuclear warhead, your regime is over. That was his statement. Now, Uncle Joe Biden, to me, has the screen presence, and he's a straight talker. Non-offensive straight talk, I think, is what the American public would adhere to more so than just the political line. Okay, Hillary Clinton, I don't think, has a chance. if you want to know who the Republican candidate would be, all you have to do is bug, what's his name, Sheldon Adelson's, you know, his office, because it was really kind of disturbing to me when I was watching, I think it was Face the Nation or one of them, when the discussion was who he was going to throw his money behind. Mm-hmm. So I think Joe Biden will probably be the last man standing, and he's got a better chance than Hillary Clinton, I believe, because he's a straight talker. You know, he can step, put his foot in his mouth sometimes, but I think people would really really rather hear the straight talk as opposed to a political line. Thanks, Mr. Steiner.
Wow.
I love that guy.
Who do you love?
The caller we just had. And Joe Biden. I've been saying that my vice president should be my next president since he became the vice president and he didn't make the primary and he lost to Barack. I love Joe Biden. And that's exactly, and on the Republican side, I think the Joe Biden equivalent is Chris Christie. That's exactly where we are now. We have seen ourselves get duped by great PR teams and branding to elect empty shells like Martin O'Malley, like George W. Bush.
It didn't work for Anthony Brown, though.
He didn't use the same team. He didn't use the same. And you saw Martin O'Malley going to defensive immediately to explain that he didn't use their team.
He turned his back on Martin O'Malley's team.
Yes, he did.
So what about this
straight talk?
Edward, and also let's talk about the Republicans for a minute before I ask you all another question.
I don't know about Joe Biden. Is he even interested? I mean,
I have a time for some Joe for 2016 t-shirt already. You have to follow him on Twitter. It's just about, you know, timing and
I don't know whether you're going to come through the doors of a Republican, independent, or Democrat, girl.
But the other thing, Chris Christie has had his share of PR scandals and has, although comes across as a straight shooter to us that just tells it like it is. I mean, look at some of what he's been able to or how he's had to navigate around. Bridgegate that he had to navigate around. So I don't know if he's as same kind of straight shooter that you're referring
to.
The
millennials now outnumber baby boomers as a voting bloc.
Okay.
If we vote, but I'm working on that, okay? Trying to get them there. But we are more forgiving of an authentic human than we are willing to be sold on somebody who looks perfect.
So, Edward, sitting in between millennials and boomers.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, you guys just covered so much there. First of all, I wanted to agree with the point that the equivalent on the Republican side of Joe Biden is Chris Christie. My only problem with Chris Christie being elevated in the way that he was, which I think is largely our media. I think in the same way that Rand Paul is being considered as a viable candidate, it's very odd. I think his candidacy in a lot of ways has been created by MSNBC and CNN because liberals have wanted to see a Republican who was a straight shooter and who did seem to have some principle and wasn't beholden to the Tea Party base. But the truth of the matter is the Republican Party is far more united in their principles than the Democratic Party is. And to that end, a Rand Paul and a Chris Christie, though they might seem to be a bit more mainstream, are actually still beholden to the rich, to tax cuts for the rich. Chris Christie held up Obamacare in the state of New Jersey, a very liberal state with a great deal of poverty in it. And as a result, a lot of people, they still don't have access to health care despite Obamacare being in its second year at this point. This is not a man who cares about the poor, who even cares about the middle class even. I think the latest scandal, like the other panelists were saying, wasn't just the Bridgegate, but also the fact that he had spent so much money on private jets or something like that. And I think his response was, well, I got to enjoy it while I can. It's like, this is not a man of the people, but yet because he yells and screams at people in a town hall with that sort of New Jersey flair, he's somehow elevated as a man of the people in an Archie Bunker type sense. That is problematic because essentially you have the press choosing our candidates for us while people go uninformed, unfed, and without health care. I think that I don't know where I was going after that.
That was fine because now you gave us a New England, I mean, a New York, New Jersey schooling on Governor Christie, which we needed to hear.
Yep.
Let me switch gears for a moment. You know, and I'm going to talk to this kind of very complex and confusing battleground that President Obama's fast-track trade deal is having in Congress for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, we saw the 44, 46 Democratic senators voted against the bill moving forward. Then on Thursday, when it came time for the Senate to vote on whether or not fast track authority should be debated, 11 of those same Democrats voted to bring it to the floor, the TPP, to bring it a step closer to that kind of reality. Bill Curry, who writes for Salon, said, quote, "The TPP may prove to be the most significant surrender of sovereignty in our nation's history," end quote. Now, Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, has from the outside has led this fight against TPP. Now people are rallying around her in the Senate and places. This is a very huge political question. And I think that in President Barack Obama saying, just trust me. But then when you read the fine print, there's a lot of questions about whether just trust me is right.
Well, the problem, Mark, is that we haven't read the fine print. Mm-hmm. There were bits of it that were leaked by WikiLeaks, and I think that's what started this anti-TPP agenda on the far left. I don't know enough about any fine line, because actually all the articles that you guys sent and that I did the read up on, it showed that we actually had very little information, and even Congress itself, most of the members of Congress still haven't gotten a full debrief about what's in the partnership. I think from the president's perspective, the agenda is such that he has been trying to pivot to Asia as trade partners in order to create some balance and competition with China. Because at the end of the day, on the trajectory is that China will become the world's largest economy, and they will be in a position to dictate at the UN and on issues like this, on trade. And so I think the president is trying to prepare the country for that new reality. In the same way that the British empire, when it fell and the U.S. became the world power, it's very likely that in 50 years, China will be far more powerful than it is today. And the U.S. will have to find new ways of competing and new partners in that competition. And I think that's the basis for the TPP. What it outlines in terms of how labor unions are affected, I think is the worry of people like Warren, because at the end of the day, our workers are already being exploited. Their work is already being sent overseas, and I think the TPP is being seen as another way that that's going to happen, and it's going to hurt American workers. And the president will need to answer to that, and we will need to see the fine print on that, but as of now, we haven't.
You know, I think that the idea that President Barack Obama wants to push it through without anybody knowing what it means,
yeah,
and when you do the research and reading about the TPP, there are a lot of questions about the power it gives to corporations, about the inability to stop anything, America being stopped from doing certain things it wants to do if it goes in TPP with 11 countries from mm-hmm. around the Pacific, and there's and we've seen already what these trade agreements have meant for Colombia. In South America, which has actually led to a great deficit with the United States. Mm-hmm. It hasn't boosted the United States or created jobs. There are a lot of questions here, I think, that people want to see answered.
So for me, it's really interesting that it appears that Obama wants this to be part of his legacy that's left, when we have so much information of what these other unions or agreements have done, and that they haven't glowingly been successful for many of us or the country as a whole, that why then is this such an important step for him to push forward on?
We can take a very quick break, come right back, and then I'll read a couple of tweets that have come in about our last segment about Martin O'Malley. I want to read these tweets when we come back from our listeners. 410-319-8888 is number here to join in this conversation. We want to hear more from you. Losing My Religion, R.E.M., from their album Out of Time, which hit number one on this day in 1991.
It's bigger. It's bigger than you. And you are not me. The links that I will go to. The distance in
Transmission by Joy Division. Ian Curtis of Joy Division committed suicide on this day in 1980. We are here with our three guests, Edward Wyckoff Williams, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, and Catalina Byrd, and you at 410-319-8888. Matthew tweeted in, on Martin O'Malley, "Someone who is not willing to be honest about his contribution to mass incarceration does not deserve political leadership." Brittany tweeted in on the same subject, "He would not get my vote. I heard this a lot. His get tough on crime policies are related to Baltimore riots." So those are two tweets we just got in, and let's go right to the phones. Unless you want to jump in very quickly, Kat.
I just wanted to make a point to what Kim was saying before we went to break, and that why President Obama would want TPP to be a part of his legacy. NAFTA seemed like a good idea.
Absolutely.
At the time. And we didn't understand the repercussions of that as a country and what it did to the workforce and the laborers until it was too late.
Right.
And so one of the reasons I think that he's being so secretive to an extent is I really think that he's worked very hard to put together what might fix NAFTA. And the same way we didn't know how bad NAFTA was, we won't know how good TPP is.
Well,
I could be just an Obama optimist. I think he's trying to fix what NAFTA broke.
I'll pause something here, then go to the phones. You all can beat me up, but I'm going to throw it out anyway.
No, remember, we're starting the Marxist sale. So
that's
maybe.
Right. I think that TPP, like NAFTA, is an agreement carved out
by corporations,
in their interest. Just like you're seeing, where President Barack, you see the power of that money when you see the president opening up the Atlantic coast to oil drilling, now opening up the Arctic to oil drilling in some very dangerous areas where if there's a spill there, it would be disaster. Rather than thinking about, because the oil industry is making tons, all this money. It's also directly related to what's happening in many ways around the Strait of Hormuz and Yemen and there. And so this is the part of things we don't want to get under to deal with, which is some of the things that Bernie Sanders is talking about, not that he ever could be president, but that he is trying to raise, I think, on these issues as well. I think it's time for us to have in the next week a TPP debate here, which Mark Gunnery.
How do you debate something you can't?
Because you do know about it. People do know about it.
We don't know a lot, though.
Right. But people do know about it. You can have that debate with people who know more than we do about what the pros and cons are and why people are so upset about this and why the Senate is kind of bucking up against the president, his own Democrats. But
you know what I'm going to do, Mark?
What's that?
I'm going to book Valerie Jarrett for your show, and I would love for you to have, actually just take her to task on TPP. I think that
you do it, I'll do it.
The best that it can be.
Brother, if that happened,
why you want to put my girl in the line of fire, sir?
I'm coming to New York to take you to dinner. Let's do that.
Excellent. I will do it. I'll do it for you.
All right, cool. Thank you, man. We'll do that. That would be a good conversation to have, and I would look forward to that. 410-319-8888. Jason in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I always love when you guys do the parlor game of politics and future presidential races. I'm calling about the TPP. I'm so glad you guys are discussing this issue. I just want to also point out that every union in the United States is against this bill. You know, every trade deal that America has signed since NAFTA has sucked jobs out of our country. You know, Ross Perot had a famous debate with Al Gore on Larry King Live. And Ross Perot had a famous statement. His statement was, once you sign this deal, you're going to hear a sucking sound. And that sucking sound is going to be jobs leaving this country. This president has, since he's been elected, has continually have betrayed the left, and this is another betrayal of the left. That's why this will not be public, because he can't let the left know what's actually in this deal. You know, the leaks that are being put out are quite frightening on, you know, exactly what they want to do. I just say, talk to trade unions, talk to national union leaders, and there's a lot of information out there why unions oppose it. 100% of the unions in the United States are against this deal.
Jason, thanks for that call. I think that there are a lot of things here, and personally, look, my initial reaction is to really question TPP in very serious ways. I want to learn more, and I intend to do so over the next few days of kind of really reading as much as I humanly possible about what this bill is doing, and what it really says, and how. I mean, one little few, some of the leaks you see say protecting the rights of large investors and corporations at the expense of workers, and there's the labor chapter is outlines things in kind of very frightening ways. I mean, I think there are a lot of things here for us to look at, and I think that we have to have that kind of debate about where this is taking us. I do want to, you know, I mean, I'm no longer.
Can we also just be fair in explaining that big corporations operate just like the unions, and whenever the union
is
upset,
the same.
It is because they price themselves out of the market. They have a lot of power, especially in the candidates and who gets elected.
That's a Republican myth.
It's not a myth at all. You are, oh my goodness, C-Mark. Unions are a big corporation in and of themselves. They have priced themselves kind of sort of out of the market, and they don't always help the workers. If you talk to actual union employees, or in Maryland, state employees who don't belong to the union but still have to pay union dues,
they
are as much a part of a big corporation or are. And let's just be fair when we're talking about them. Like, it's this ominous big gob or something that's going against the little guy. They're not really the little guy. They've got an arsenal. They've got some money.
I do see unions as a political force in our society.
They are a political force.
Absolutely. That part needs to be
considered. That's like comparing the black middle class to the white middle class in power.
Mm. Whoa, Mark.
No.
You went there.
Yes, I did.
What is today?
One has huge depth of wealth and history, and one has very shallow depth of wealth that can only put so much money out into the field. Corporations have limitless money put out in the field. There's not the same, there's no way to equating union power. Unions lost its power. They're down to nothing because of all the laws that have been passed to push unions out of work because of the deindustrialization of America, which built the black middle class. It was the unions in the city and every state in America that built the black middle class.
Well, I mean, this theory that we're going to go back to where our heyday of making things.
Did I say that?
Technology has evolved.
I didn't say that.
So, I mean, so that in and of itself, they're not necessary. We're building generations of
entrepreneurs.
Whenever
there's a boss
now,
and a worker, there's a necessary for a union not to be. People won't be exploited by the people who own the
You
businesses.
Don't need a union to not be exploited. You need to read a book.
Oh,
and
please.
If necessary,
well,
get a lawyer.
I can say this much, which is basically agreeing with both of you that that what we saw in Wisconsin with Governor, what's the guy's
name? Walker.
Scott Walker.
Yeah, Scott Walker. If those unions had no power, he wouldn't have been so hell-bent on destroying them. And I think that just goes to show that the unions were strong in terms of rallying people to vote, mm-hmm. in terms of supporting candidates and getting candidates on the ticket. And so they did have a certain kind of power, but I think it's a very different kind of power that corporations have and the deeply entrenched money that corporations have in Washington. And so I would not say that the unions have been completely destroyed and completely undermined and that they don't have power, because they do. But it is, like Mark said, the difference between the black middle class and the white middle class. We're talking about $40,000 a year as opposed to $90,000.
410-319-8888. Theodore and Carney are on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning,
Theodore. To you. And in reference to us not going back, we could. Absolutely, we could. But greed is the thing that stops us. Plus the foolishness of the American consumer. They got us in a bind. Any cheap good that comes from China, we can make. Any fabric that comes from overseas, we can make. But what happened? The people, the shareholders who own the companies have decided, and the people that run them, that they're more important. Their profits are more important. I'll give you an example. In 96, I think it was, Levi Strauss made $800 million. By 98, they made $500 million. Now, what do? They closed up shop and went overseas. Now, they're still making money. $500 million from profit, $800 million, that's a difference of $300 million. They don't come on the news and say, we made $500 million. No, they say they lost $300 million. So what happens is that we are in a bind. Where else do we go? But I think it starts with one person, say, sitting down at a machine and making something using our innate talent. Unions are needed. They are necessary. In fact, when you talk about the black middle class, the Republicans, they basically want to destroy it. They don't want union shops in Republican states. And to give you an example, look at the post office. The post office and the government, those are the jobs that have employed black people for generations because the racism in private industry prevented us from getting jobs.
That's
so
it.
If we destroy the post office and places like that, that creates more poverty. But I think we can go back, even technologically. And people who say we can't go back, That's people, for some reason, who don't want to go back. Why can't you make an automobile? Is an automobile made by robots better than the ones made by hands? Absolutely not. So when you say you can't go back, that's not true. Many people we're comfortable. We're comfortable in buying cheap goods, mm-hmm. and that's what these plans, these trade plans do. They'll say, well, look, we'll lose some jobs, but what does the American consumer get back? He gets cheap goods, so he'll have to pay much. So don't say that we can't go back. We simply don't choose to, because you're sitting there saying, with
Peter, I have to get the next caller because we're almost out of time in this segment. But I hear what you're saying. I mean, you have to hang up on him. I just wanted to tell him that. That we have to get the next caller before we run out of time in this segment. And quick closing thoughts, because we have to turn to Big Jim and B.B. King here. 410-319-8888, which is important as well. Paul, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
Very good. Good morning, Paul.
Long time no hear from you.
Good to hear from you.
I'm somewhat in agreement. I'm poor. I've been poor. And this is an attack on poor people in general, not just blacks. It's attacking everybody. It's creating, like, the Hatfields and the McCormicks or the Kennedys and the Reagans and things. People that have money are going to be the ones that be able to survive. Everybody else is almost like getting scraps and stuff again. So what your counterpart said about the unions being effective and things like that, I thought we used to have a lot of pull, but we don't no more, because the big businesses are able to put all that money and lobby and they let this out lobbying us, and it's not what's right, it's what makes the money that's more interesting to the people that we put in office. It's like they don't flip the switch on us.
Paul, I'm sorry I have to jump in because we're almost out of time, but we look forward to have you back on the air with us soon. Paul is a union activist in our community. Very quick closing thoughts from our guests, because we have to move on here.
Consumers don't want to pay high prices. And that's why we're in the space that we're currently in, because they are unwilling to pay the money that it requires us to make the products here in the U.S. and then pay for those products. Instead, we ship them abroad so that we can keep the low cost of those products.
And it's a catch-22 when the consumers are experiencing stagnant wages and have been for the
Absolutely.
Last 40 years.
Absolutely.
They can't actually afford to buy products at a higher price anyway.
I concur with my colleagues.
I wish we had more time to do this. We will come back and have the three of you back on. And you two are great. All three are great together. It's good to have the three of you here in the studio at the same time doing this. It's always good to have Catalina Bird in the house. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
And always my dear friend Edward Wyckoff Williams. Good to hear your voice,
Absolute
brother.
Absolute pleasure, buddy.
And Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, thank you, as
thank
always.
Thank you.
And we'll take a very brief break and come right back. And when we come back, you hear that? Do you hear that?
Yes, that's Lucille.
There you go, girl. That's it. There it is. B.B. King. The king is gone. We can talk about him. Big Jim is coming in the house.
It's from my guitar that's named Lucille. I'm very crazy about Lucille. Lucille took me from the plantation. Oh, and you might say, brought me fame. I don't think I could just talk enough about Lucille.